Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We have in the studio with us Wes Moore, whose name and book has been touted around the country recently, has many Baltimore roots. We'll be talking about that during the course of the hour. The book is The Other Wes Moore, One Name, Two Fates. The chilling truth is that his story could have been mine. The tragedy is that my story could have been his. Wes, welcome.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Good to have you. Why don't you introduce the book to us by reading that first paragraph in your introduction?
Thank you. This is the story of two boys living in Baltimore with similar histories and an identical name, Wes Moore. One of us is free and has experienced things that he never even knew to dream about as a kid. The other will spend every day until his death behind bars for an armed robbery that left a police officer and father of five dead. The chilling truth is that his story could have been mine. The tragedy is that my story could have been his. Our stories are obviously specific to our two lives, but I hope they will illuminate the crucial inflection points in every life, the sudden moments of decision where our paths diverge and our fates are sealed. It's unsettling to know how little separates each of us from another life altogether.
And it's funny, you know, I, in a very strange way, because I do remember things, and I remember when Sergeant Prothero was murdered.
Yeah.
And I remember the headline about you before I even knew who you were.
Yeah, and I mean, it was just amazing because that story about the other Wes and Sergeant Prothero's death. I mean, you remember. I mean, it gripped the city.
Oh my God.
Here is a person who was a true hero, a 3-time winner of Police Officer of the Year, a father of five who had triplets, and the only reason he was even working that day was because he was trying to make extra money for his family, and he went to work and he didn't come home. And, you know, just you watch the way that the city was just, you know, just held their breath for those 12 days until all four guys were captured. And then it was through that process that I learned that one of the four guys that were captured was also named Wes Moore.
And when you heard this Wes Moore's name and story, you were out of the country yourself.
I was.
You were in South Africa.
I was in South Africa. I was doing a study abroad program while I was a student at Johns Hopkins. And I was on the phone with my mother. And she said, I've got something crazy to tell you. She said, there are wanted posters all over your neighborhood. Because I was living in Baltimore at that time. She was living out in Anne Arundel County. She said, there are wanted posters all over your neighborhood for a man wanted for the murder of a police officer, and they're looking for Wes Moore. And when she said it, I was almost like, excuse me? And she's like, there are wanted posters for Wes Moore, and if you see him, do not approach because he's assumed to be armed and very dangerous. And it was really that initial curiosity about the name that grabbed me. But then as I got back to the United States and I read more articles and I learned more, I realized how much more we had in common than just our name. The fact that we both came up in single-parent households, the fact that we both were around the same age. We both had troubles academically and in terms of the neighborhood growing up. And so that's when I wanted to explore this deeper. And I said, you know, there's questions I want to ask, but I knew he was the only one that could provide the answers. So I eventually decided to reach out to him.
And you, a student at Hopkins, who was going to be a Fulbright scholar.
Rhodes Scholar.
I meant Rhodes, polish me. Rhodes Scholar.
Yeah.
First Rhodes Scholar at Hopkins in 13 years. I remember that from your book.
That's right. Veteran
from who fought the 82nd Airborne in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And now you're searching for this other Wes Moore.
Yeah.
Also African-American, but in jail.
Yeah.
And you wrote him a letter.
I did. I wrote him a letter, and basically the first letter, I just asked him a series of questions that in retrospect almost seem a bit naive now, but I learned a little bit about him through the articles because the Baltimore Sun and all the local papers were doing a whole series of articles on this tragedy. And so I asked him about, does he see his children? Because I knew Wes had children through the articles. I asked him, does he see his brother? Because I knew his brother was a trigger man. That day who actually, you know, pulled the trigger and killed Sergeant Prothero.
Tony,
that's right. And then a month later, and to my surprise, because I wasn't expecting to hear back from him. I just knew that I had to write this letter. And if I heard back, then I heard back. And then a month later, I get an envelope back from Jessup Correctional Institution from Wes Moore. And in the letter, he first said how much it meant to him that I wrote him, because he said, when you're in prison, you think no one thinks you exist anymore. And then he proceeded just to answer all my questions. And which triggered more questions, and then eventually that one letter turned into dozens of letters, and those dozens of letters have turned into dozens of visits now with Wes.
When was the last time you saw him?
I say the last time I saw him was about 2 or 3 months ago.
So since the book has been out, you've seen him?
Not since the book has been out, but recently before the book came out.
Okay.
I went to go see him. He's had a chance to read the book, though, and I've, you know, been in touch. In fact, I was just in touch with his mother just about a week back.
It's interesting. I mean, as we jump into your story for a moment, do you intend to maintain a relationship with this other Wes Moore?
You know, I didn't get in touch with Wes to write the book. So my mentality has always been that I don't see why I would stop being in touch now that the book is written. You know, I think I've grown a tremendous amount as a person because of this process, because I think I better understand my own life. I better understand the blessings, and I better appreciate, you know, the way that my life has turned out. And I think Wes feels much the same way. You know, I'm not sure how long, you know, our communication will last. But again, I didn't get in touch with him to write the book, so
who
I don't
knows?
See why I would cut it off, you know,
right.
Because it's now out.
It could last a day, a month, for the rest of your life. You just don't know.
Right. You just don't know.
You don't know.
You just don't know.
Well, what's interesting to me is Wes Moore, the man who's incarcerated for participating in the murder of Sergeant Prothero.
Yeah.
I was thinking about what you wrote about him in the book and also what you said about him in the epilogue, mm-hmm. and the contradiction. Because I think you said, you can explain this better than
yeah.
I, obviously, but that he has not taken responsibility for his acts.
That's right.
But B, he seems to be playing a positive role in his own life and the life of other inmates by becoming a leader of the Muslim community in prison.
Yeah. And that contradiction actually always fascinates me as well, because I think even in the times that I've known him, I've seen a certain, you know, level of growth in terms of his involvement inside of the prison and him trying to work with younger inmates. Who, you know, because again, for 95% of people in prison, they're coming out. Only 5% are Wes, who are going to be in prison for life
right.
without parole. So he's been trying to work more with the one who are in the 95% who are getting out and trying to help to show them that this is not the type of life that they want to lead. But I talk about it in the book, there's a scene where we're talking about his insistence
right.
that he wasn't there. And I say in the book, you know, his insistence confounded me then, and it still confounds me to this day. So that contradiction is not lost to me at all.
Because before his brother died, he never said his brother wasn't there.
That's right. Which
he would have done that had his brother not been there.
I mean, in fact, in the book, I kind of lay out all the different pieces of evidence that were used to convict
right.
him.
Right.
His DNA being at the scene and you know, them fleeing to Philadelphia. That was the one that always most confused me, was that why his brother never once said, because even after his brother pleaded out, his brother said, listen, I'm guilty, I'm the trigger man, and he got life without parole. Why his brother never once said, my brother wasn't there that day. That was the piece that always confused me. And I've asked Wes and, you know, haven't really gotten an answer on that.
Maybe there was no answer to that. Yeah. But you know, your life and these two Wes Moores, you grew up in Maryland for the first part of your life before your family went to the Bronx. Your mother
yeah.
went to you. So talk about you growing up in Baltimore. I mean, in Maryland.
In Maryland. Well, you know, the place in Maryland that we grew up in was a quiet community that was becoming increasingly not quiet anymore. You know, it had a chance with my, you know, with my father in the house and my mother in the house and myself and my two sisters. But it all just came to an abrupt end in mid-April of 1982. My father was in the radio business, radio and television.
I know that was Westmore,
yeah.
right.
And
right.
He finished a show. He was doing the evening news, and he finished a show. And then he came home, and he felt like, you know, his throat was bothering him. Didn't know if it was strep throat or whatever else. And he came home, and we were already asleep. And then he went to my mother. They had their dinner. He tried to take Tylenol, and it ended up getting almost lodged in his throat because he wasn't able to swallow it. The next morning, he woke up and said, I really need to go to the hospital. And he went to the hospital. And my mother dropped us off with a sitter, and then she met him over at the hospital. And the diagnosis came back. They weren't sure if it was a strep throat. Questions were asked to my mother, is my father prone to exaggeration? And he was released from the hospital with the instructions to get some rest. And then 5 hours later, my mother was in the kitchen with my sisters, and I was at the dining room table. And I heard him coming down the stairs. And I did what every 3.5-year-old would do when you hear your parent come the stairs. I ran to the stairs so he could pick me up. As soon as he got to the bottom, and then I watched him collapse and fall and just start reaching for his throat and just gasping for air. Then I heard a crash in the kitchen, and my mother ran from the kitchen inside because she heard the crash. My sister was calling 911, and I just remember just standing there watching, just staring at him gasping for air. And then the ambulance, the first responders came quickly to the scene. They tried to get him to the hospital, but by the time he got to the hospital, it was too late. He passed away. And my mother had significant troubles with that. I mean, here she was instantaneously this you know, woman in her late 20s who now is a widow with three children. And despite having a lot of, you know, we have, you know, my dad's side of the family who's still down in Maryland and her friends from college who are still here, she needed more support, and she needed support that she knew only her parents could give. So she moved, about 2 years after he passed away, we moved from Maryland and we moved up to the Bronx to go live with my grandparents in their small home in the Bronx, which was a great experience, I think, for my mother, because it provided her some leverage that she needed. But I think that the Bronx was going through some significant transitions at that point.
It wasn't the Bronx of your mother's childhood.
It wasn't the Bronx of my mother's childhood. And she said, you know, when she didn't first see crime until she left New York to go down to Washington, D.C. And then she came back to the Bronx. And in the Bronx in the mid-1980s, we're in the middle of this huge crack cocaine epidemic, where you're watching communities that were literally just burnt out as far as the eye could see. And you watch how these little rocks in little vials were just transforming communities.
Right.
And the Bronx was one of the many ground zeros around the country. And so as I was coming up and kind of going through my process of, A, trying to understand why it was just my mom now. Because I think when my father passed away, I knew he'd gone. I just wasn't sure where he went. And as I got older, I started to better understand death and him leaving and what that meant. And it turned into fear and anger and hurt. And I think when you combine that with a rapidly changing neighborhood, it just led to this cocktail of bad grades, troubles in the classroom, troubles in the neighborhood. And eventually my mother decided, she said, I've got to intervene. I've got to do something. Because as she said, you know, I lost my husband. I don't want to lose my son, too.
Well, there's a great quote in this book. And let's see if I have this right. Oh, here, I do have it right here. I think I have this right. It's close to this anyway. This is about the other Wes Moore talking to you. And he said, your father wasn't there because he couldn't be.
Yeah.
My father wasn't there because he chose not to be. And we're going to mourn their absence in different ways.
Yeah. One of the topic of fatherhood is one that comes up pretty often when I sit with Wes, and not just about the role of our fathers in our lives, or not being in our lives, but also, you know, his role. I mean, he's now not only a father, but Wes became a grandfather at 33 years old. And so we talk a lot about what the role of fathers are in their children's lives. And when he said that to me, when he said, you know, your father wasn't there because he couldn't be, and my father wasn't there because he chose not to be, and we're going to mourn their absence in different ways, I told him, I said, I completely agree with you. But I think one thing we both also agreed with is that hole that's left inside of a young child, boy or girl, who don't have that father inside of the home, is a lot of times you'll find young people who will try to fill that hole in many cases, you know, unproductive and dangerous ways, because it leads to a level of confusion. Regardless of the reason, it leads to a level of anger and a level of hurt and a level of denial that I think will then turn itself and manifest itself into, you know, some of the actions that we see where, you know, you have young people, and particularly young boys, who are trying to understand this process of manhood and feel like that guide who's supposed to help them make that transition just isn't there.
It's difficult for all kids, as you said, who lose a dad. As we wind our way back to your story and what happened to you in the street and how you ended up in this military academy and that very interesting sojourn in your life there, but almost also didn't make it, which we'll get to. But one of the things that really hit me was the story that Wes Moore tells about going to his grandparents' house, because he loved his grandparents. He was close to his grandparents, his father's parents.
Yeah.
And his father was laying there on the couch.
Yeah. And it's interesting because Wes has a very close relationship, had a very close relationship with his paternal grandmother, which I found fascinating because her son, it was the father of Wes and just wanted nothing to do with him. And at that point, Wes had only seen his father two times in his life. And Wes went over to his grandmother's house to go see him, and he was with his older brother, Tony. And his father was sleeping on the couch. And Tony says to Wes, almost in jest, say, hey, there's your dad. You should go say hello to him. And Wes took it seriously. So Wes actually went up to him and tapped him on the shoulder. His father was sleeping.
And Wes is how old then?
And Wes is now at that point
14?
14, yeah, 13, 14,
right.
Yeah. And he taps him on the shoulder, and his father doesn't wake. And then Wes taps him again, taps him a little harder. And then his father wakes up and opens his eyes and looks at Wes, and he says, who are you? Mm. And Wes, I remember Wes telling me the pain. Well, he said he had a couple of mixed emotions. One, he said he was almost relieved in a way because he said that uncomfortable conversation that he was dreading to have with his father, he knew now wouldn't have to take place. And he also said, but at the same time, that pain, it felt like someone was literally just cutting you. Because this is your flesh and blood. This is who you came from. And he looks you in the face and he has no idea who you even are. And that was the last time that Wes ever saw his father.
That's just that story really hit me hard when I read that one little piece of that.
And in fact, I remember even as I was going through the process of doing research, I actually even tried finding Wes's father because I wanted to try to interview him, and I couldn't find him. He's lost in the streets, and according to Wes, because I asked Wes, said, "Who do I touch? Who can I contact to get in touch with your father?" And Wes said, "I don't even know if he's alive anymore." He said, "I have no idea where he is." And then I tried to do the research, and I couldn't find him, so I have no idea where he is now.
So going back to your story in the Bronx, so you got into a little bit of trouble in the street.
Yeah, we did. I think as my mother was saying, my mother said, I was a smart kid. I just had a great way of hiding it. But I was in school, and what ended up happening was that my mother, the neighborhood schools that we had inside the Bronx were also, in addition to the neighborhoods, just changing rapidly. I mean, literally, when I was, believe at that time, I must have been seventh grade. There was a girl in my neighborhood school who actually went to school and was shot in the face, and it became national news of what was happening at the school, literally up the street from where I went to, for where I lived. And my mother made a decision pretty early. She said, I'm not going to have him go to the schools in the area. So she ended up working multiple jobs in order to send me to a school across town, which she thought was the best thing for me because it had a great reputation and it was a school with very affluent kids and so on and so forth. But in many ways, that's a school where I got most lost because I quickly found myself being too, quote unquote, rich for the kids in the neighborhood.
Your neighborhood.
In my neighborhood, who didn't understand why I thought I was so much better than everybody that I had to go to school across town. And then two, quote-unquote, poor for the kids in my school who didn't understand why I lived across town and what my neighborhood was like. And so I found myself almost on this little island by myself and just constantly searching for acceptance and looking for someone to just kind of bring me in. And I found myself being very uncomfortable in my own skin because I really had no idea where I anchored. And so in addition to bad grades, I then was getting in trouble in the neighborhood. In fact, one scene that I talk about in the book was a friend which had just come from working. And what I mean by working, he was a runner. So basically he was one of the young kids who moved packages, drug packages, from one side of town to the other side of town. And the reason that a lot of dealers use young kids is because cops generally don't search them.
That's right.
And so he just finished his job. He's 11 years old. And he saw me. I just finished playing a game of basketball, and he said, "You want to tag?" And what tagging is spray painting, and whatever your moniker, whatever your little insignia is. And I was like, "Yeah, of course, cool." And so reach in, we grab the spray paint cans, we shake them up so it comes out clean and even. And I put my little KK next to each other, which was Kid Cupid, which was my little self-imposed name. And as soon as I finish up, we see a cop car turn the corner, and it did his little, whoop, whoop, the sounds of a cop car coming. And so we look at each other, and then we start bolting in different directions. And I was the really brilliant one who ran in the direction of the cops. They grab me. They put handcuffs on me. They throw me in the back of the car. And then they finally grab him, throw him in the back of the car as well. And I am terrified. I'm just thinking to myself, oh, God, I have no idea what I just did. I never felt so vulnerable because I knew at this point I didn't have control over my past, my present, or my future.
They had control of you.
They had control over me. And the two cops came in the car. One of them turned around, gave us a lecture, and then both of them got out of the car and they let us out and they took the handcuffs off us and they said, "Now get moving." And I made a vow to myself that day that I would never get caught in a situation like that again. I would never put myself in a situation like that again. And then a week later, there I was, four blocks down the road, doing the same stuff. And so my mother decided, she's like, I'm not going to keep doing this. And I'm not going to continue to work as hard as she was working to have him putting together subpar results at best. And she saw what was happening to so many kids around the neighborhood. And so that's when she decided that she needed to do something different and sent me off to a military school.
And so you end up at this Valley Forge
Yeah.
Military Academy.
Yeah.
Which is funny. That was the school I was almost sent to as a kid for similar reasons. I didn't end up there, but that's really funny. I remember when they were going to send me there. And So, but you were sent there, and your experience there was, you hated it there.
Oh, I mean, hate is a nice way of putting it.
You wanted out.
I wanted out. I literally ran away 5 times in the first 4 days. Every time they turned their backs, I was sprinting to the gates and just trying to climb over the gates and trying to get out of that place. I mean, because it was so foreign to me. It was so different. I didn't know anybody there. And it was in the middle of nowhere. And I was used to being in a city. And just there was nothing about that place that I liked when I first showed up.
So here comes this guy in your room in the middle of the night.
So my squad leader comes in my room. And they all had known that I kept on making these attempts to leave because they always had to bring me back. And I was trying to find this train station that was in Wayne, Pennsylvania, that would take me to 30th Street in Philadelphia, which would take me to Penn Station in New York, and I could take the 2 train from there back up to the Bronx. And he kicks my roommate out of the room. And so it's just me and him in the room. And I was at first terrified because I'm like, okay, obviously he's about to do something that he wants no witnesses for. So he tells me to sit down. And he said, Moore, it's obvious you don't want to be here, and quite honestly, we don't want you here. So I've drawn you a map on how to get to this train station. And he literally drew out this map on how to get to this train station. So I'm so thankful for him. I'm literally almost in tears. I'm so happy. And then later on that night, I plan my great escape. And so that night, I'm running around through the woods trying to follow this map as best I could, 20 paces here, 30 paces there, whatever. And after what seemed like a couple hours, it was probably like 15 minutes, I just start crying because I'm scared and I'm hearing wild animals that weren't there, but I'm just terrified.
The wild animals of suburban Philly.
The wild animals of suburban Philly, right? And like I said, it was almost like the Serengeti. It might as well have been. And then I start hearing more rustling leaves, and I thought it was just more lions. And then I start hearing laughter. And it was my chain of command. They'd follow me out. The map was fake. The map took you to the middle of the woods. But they just wanted to see how bad I wanted to go home. And they got their answer that night that I wanted to go home pretty bad.
This was Sergeant Austin.
That was Sergeant Austin, yeah. And I remember when I saw him in those woods, too. I looked at him, and I was like, I thought we were cool, man. Why would you do this to me?
But then you had a conversation with your mom.
I did. And then we were in the middle of plea system, which meant we weren't allowed any outside communication. But they said, we're going to allow you to make one phone call. So I called my mom, and I was begging her to let me come back home. And she stopped me, and she said, too many people have sacrificed in order for you to be here. And too many people are rooting for you. And your father's looking down on you, and he's proud of you. And we all just want you to give it a shot. And while it didn't happen overnight by any stretch, that conversation started to mean something to me because I started to understand I was part of something bigger, that my life meant more to more people than just me. And I started to understand accountability and leadership and the role that I had in helping my plea brothers and their role in helping me. And so that's when I think a transition started to take place.
And you went there until you went to Hopkins.
I did.
Graduated high school from.
That's right. I ended up graduating. I had 1 year mandatory, but then I asked if I could stay. And the school worked out financially that I stuck around and then ended up joining the Army out of there, getting commissioned as an officer in the Army, and then transferring to Johns Hopkins.
So how old were you when you went to Hopkins?
I first went to Hopkins at 19. I finished when I was 22.
So you went to the Army before that, that's right. And then you went to Hopkins.
Yes.
So, okay. Here you are, Wes Moore, but you had your mom and your grandparents. Your grandfather was, I forget which way it went. Your grandfather was Jamaican. Your grandmother was Cuban.
Yes,
right, yeah. Right. So, and your grandfather was the first.
Yeah, first black minister in the history of the Dutch Reformed Church. Yeah,
wild.
Yeah. which is because again, now that was the official church of apartheid South Africa,
right?
And now here he is, this very very dark skinned Jamaican who now becomes the first black minister in the history of
Teddy Roosevelt's church.
That's exactly right. That's why I actually tell people when they say Dutch Reform, like it was Teddy Roosevelt's church. They're like, oh, okay.
so and you had your Uncle Howard.
Yes.
Who was like a surrogate dad to you,
yeah.
Along with your grandfather, and your mother who went to college, working her tail off to make sure that you kids, the three of you, were going to make it.
That's right.
Your sister, 2 sisters, and you.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this Wes Moore now. He's now in this military academy.
Yeah.
Save from reform school. You could have ended up somewhere else with this tagging stuff and the stuff you were being drawn into, but your mom wasn't going to let that happen. But then the other Wes Moore.
Yeah.
About this, at the time when he was 13, 14, 15 years old,
yeah.
He had a very different experience between his older brother, Tony, who was a street hood and a gangster, Mm-hmm. You have that line in here that I got to find this. Mm-hmm. It is. I know I marked it off.
It's all right.
I marked this off in this book, but it had to do with oh, here it is. I got it. With how he looked up to his brother, mm-hmm. because to Wes he thought his brother Tony was a certified gangster,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And then that typical inner city look of young men at the ice grill,
yeah,
stone yeah. cold. And so young Wes Moore, his mother struggling to work hard, but he's snatching the reefer from the house to sell it.
Yeah,
his mother flushes $4,000 worth of drugs down the toilet.
Right.
He freaks out. Figure out how he's going to pay back the boys on the street.
Yeah.
So your paths were similar, but took really different
yeah.
turns.
And that was, you know, the one thing I wanted to be, you know, clear about in terms of also highlighting is that it's not even almost a compare and contrast of the two mothers, because, you know, you look at Wes's mother, you know, this is, you know, she was the first in her family to go to college, graduated from BCCC, and then ended up getting accepted to Johns Hopkins, starting off at Johns Hopkins. And then once the Pell Grants ran out,
she had to quit.
And she never went back another day.
That says so much right there.
And so you think about how her life could have been different had she completed Johns Hopkins University, not just with the degree, but the networks and the connections that it had, and also how that would have changed the entire destiny of her entire family. So you really had two mothers who really both, you know, loved their children. But the leverage that my mother was able to rely on, the help from her parents, or, you know, her brother, my Uncle Howard, who ended up moving back to the Bronx, was something that was just, you know, again, I didn't appreciate at the time, but I realize now how important that it was. And you see it in so many cases of when you're looking at the life of, you know, of the other West, where you have parents who are, particularly single mothers, who are overstretched, who are trying to be the everything to their child. But when they're working these multiple jobs, it becomes very difficult. And in many cases, that idle time that kids have can lead in very, very wrong directions, particularly if you happen to live in a neighborhood where you feel like the neighborhood is almost working against you in terms of, you know, providing and supporting your family and your child. And it's amazing to see how quickly these things can spiral out of control. I think we saw with, you know, with the kids that I was with in the Bronx, how quickly were spiraling out of control for them. And I think it's really highlighted in the way that Wes's life is profiled, and particularly when you look at the impact that Tony had on his life.
I mean, yes.
Tony was Wes's main role model. Tony was Wes's, that was Wes's guy. And it was amazing because you saw how much Tony tried to keep Wes out, how much Tony wanted Wes to be nothing like him, and how much Wes wanted to be everything like Tony. And that dynamic between them caused a lot of tension, but eventually I think was one of the things that helped lead Wes into the wrong direction.
When I look at the photographs of the other Wes Moore,
yeah.
and the big smile on his face, his little boy, this
yeah.
beautiful face
yes.
this kid had. And then there's this picture you have of him when, right after he was charged with attempted murder in 1990.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the ice grill is on his face,
yeah.
just like on his brother's face. Even his brother had an intelligent, kind of quizzical, funny look on his face
yeah.
in that silly picture he had in front of the Mercedes-Benz.
Yeah, and that was actually one of the points that actually my mother pointed out. She said something that isn't lost to me is that you look at the pictures from, you know, from his teenage years on. She's like, there isn't one picture of him smiling.
Right.
The ice grill is on, and it's on in every single picture.
Smile in the street is a sign of weakness.
That's right. That's exactly right.
You were allowed to have your weaknesses.
Yeah.
He wasn't.
Yeah.
Smiling is weakness, but I mean,
no.
You were allowed to be able to be real and have your,
yeah.
with your emotions.
You were allowed to show that vulnerability.
Right, that's the word I'm looking for. Exactly.
You were allowed to show that, you know, that you don't always have to have the mask on. There's a beautiful poem by James Baldwin, which I think is so appropriate. It's called We Wear the Mask, and it basically starts, we wear the mask that grins and lies, and it hides our teeth and it shades our eyes. And I think it's so appropriate because you see so many kids out here who are literally wearing the mask just because they're trying to cover up a deeper hurt, cover up a deeper depression, cover up a deeper pain. And they wear the mask every day because that almost becomes the armor that they need to make it through the rest of the day.
We're talking with Wes Moore. His book is The Other Wes Moore, One Name, Two Fates. And the subtitle here is The Chilling Truth is That His Story Could Have Been Mine, The Tragedy is That My Story Could Have Been His. And Wes Moore's story is really taking America by storm. He's been on every major program. He's been in all the major newspapers. This book, we'll talk about when we come back from this break, the success of it has shocked him as much as it shocked the world. So we'll be right back to talk more with Wes Moore. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. For the 19th consecutive year, the Johns Hopkins Hospital is ranked number one by U.S. News & World Report in their annual Best Hospital Survey. Find out more about the nation's top hospital at hopkinsmedicine.org. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and we are here with Wes Moore talking about his book, The Other Wes Moore, One Name, Two Fates. I'm also fascinated by how you became almost addicted to this story.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's pretty appropriate because it was something that I thought would leave me. You know, this coincidence and these
right.
stories and these names,
yeah,
and it's
my
not
name.
A big deal. And, you know, but it just, it wouldn't. It wouldn't leave me because I said, how does this happen? How does this happen in our cities, in our country, where you have two people who can have similar backgrounds and the same name, and who end up in completely different places, completely different outliers? And that's what fascinated me. And you know, part of maybe it's just stubbornness, and part of it's just an intellectual curiosity. But I wasn't just going to let it go. And that's when I decided to actually reach out to him, see if I can get some kind of better understanding of how these dynamics take place in our society.
He seems, from what you wrote in the epilogue and some other things, he seems to be pretty grateful that you wrote this book.
Yeah, I think he was. In fact, not only is he grateful, but I think there's two things that really pushed me to write the book in the first place. One was I thought about the terribly tragic death of Sergeant Prothero, and if I could do something that could help keep these tragedies from happening again, then I thought I should do it. In the words of Edmund Burke, all it takes for evil to triumph is for good people to do nothing. And I thought about something that Wes told me, where Wes, I told Wes that someone came up to me. It was actually a friend of mine who was an author. When I told her that I had reached out to Wes, because I'd known Wes a while before, decided to turn this into a book, she said, I think this is a larger story. And I told Wes about it. And he said, listen, he's like, I've wasted every opportunity I've ever had in life. And I'm going to die in here. And if you can do something that can help people understand the ramifications for their decisions and also help people understand the neighborhoods that these decisions are being made in, then I think you should do it.
I mean, as you write about him, with everything in his life being so completely and absolutely controlled,
yeah.
from when he gets up, when he goes to bed.
When he eats, when he goes to the bathroom. And one thing I want to be very clear about is I don't give those details in order that people feel sympathetic towards him. That's not the point of this. The reason I give those details is because I want to get rid of this terrible myth that takes place in so many communities that prison is okay. That prison is, oh, you know, it's not a big deal. I have cousins there. I have uncles there. No, prison's not a game. Prison's not a joke. And the reason I wanted to give such detailed accounts of what his life is like every single day is not to make people feel sympathetic towards him, but it's to help people understand that this is not the life that you want to lead. And that's exactly the same message that Wes wanted to put out as well.
And you, I mean, in that story, I mean, it's talk about the complexity of your own emotions about this, because you certainly... While you understand everything that the other Wes Moore went through and what the streets can do to a person
yeah.
and how the streets can be their own addiction and suck you in to destroy your life, you don't see this other Wes Moore as the victim.
Yeah. And in fact, in the first pages of the book and
right.
throughout it, I say, you know, the only victims that day were Sergeant Prothero and his family. And I never make any, you know, bones about that. But one thing I try to just help... try to marry a little bit is this understanding and the complexity of the partnership of personal responsibility and societal responsibility. And while we cannot negate societal responsibility in looking at personal decisions, we also need to be able to look at societal responsibilities in making personal decisions. There was actually a scene in the book where Wes and I are talking about it, and I asked him, I said, do you think that we're products of our environments? And Wes looked at me and he said, actually, I think we're products of our expectations. And he said,
right.
he said, if people expect you to graduate from high school and expect you to graduate from college and be a good father and husband and, you know, productive member of society, then it's amazing how kids will rise to the occasion and do that. But if the expectation is that you or the people in your community will probably not graduate, will probably end up in the criminal justice system, will probably be involved in institutions for the rest of your life, then it's amazing how kids will prove you right on that too. And so I think understanding that dynamic and understanding how external expectations in many ways then become internal expectations is something that I wanted to try to highlight as well.
One of the differences for me between the two Westmores, the one Westmore was a Westmore who had a single mother, siblings, father who could care less about him, a brother who was a gangster, and this you know, he, even when he comes back from Job Corps, I've known so many kids like him who come back from Job Corps and then the streets suck you back in. We can talk about that in a minute or two. Yeah. So, and in these hard streets of Baltimore that he grew up in and became a drug dealer early. Yeah. On the other hand, the other Westmore, you, had a very different situation on some levels. I mean, you, tough streets from the Bronx and all the rest. No diminishing that. But you had grandparents who went to college. You had a mom who went to college. You had a dad who was a professional before he passed away. Yeah. You had an uncle who was like your father figure, who, you know, from playing basketball with you to basketball and teaching you lessons of life through whipping your butt on the basketball court.
That's right.
To the rest. Right. But you had people around you. Yeah. A mother who was both mothers would sacrifice. This the whole madness of what it has to be a strong black woman in today's world. Mm-hmm. Mothers who'd kind of try to take care of their children. Mm-hmm. But there were very different paths in some ways. I mean, it could have been you either way. There's no question for lots of circumstances. But the familial, communal, community arms that were around you were a great deal different than the one woman trying to keep her arms around her son and the other Westmore.
Mark, and it's such an important point. That leverage became so important. And my mother would be the first to tell you, she said if she had to do all this stuff by herself, she could not have done it. She had and she utilized and she unabashedly used whatever leverage she could around her, whether it be family, whether it be friends, whether it be community resources that she felt she needed in order to help us make that successful transition into adulthood. You know, one of the things I say in the book is sometimes that pressure of adulthood is so heavy when it's on the shoulders of a child, of kids who are really still children.
Mm-hmm.
And then our job as adults, as society, as parents and caretakers, is to basically just help lift that load a little bit, just until the shoulders are broad enough to be able to carry it themselves. But that ability to reach out and use leverage became hugely important in terms of, you know, my development, in terms of what didn't happen in the other Wes's development. Because kids are going to learn. And the question is, who's teaching them? And that will then help determine what are they going to learn and what then becomes right, what becomes wrong, and what factors does, you know, critical thinking come into the equation? At what point does personal responsibility come into the equation? And that's where, you know, kind of our role and our job as a society is to help facilitate that. And that's why even this process of this book really helped even almost change my definition of fate. Because I'm a firm believer now that fate is not something that's predestined. You know, people aren't born to be X and people aren't born to be Y. I don't buy that. I think what happens is that potential in this country is universal, but opportunity is not. And that space in between potential and opportunity and potential and results is really where we all come in. That's where family and caretakers and society as a whole and high expectations come in to help fill that void and to help really shrink that gap that exists for so many.
We're talking with Westmore, and the book is The Other Westmore. It's a very powerful story here that we're talking about in the course of this hour. And there were two people. You did 200 hours worth of interviews, if I remember right, for this book, right? And you can tell the story of Woody and how difficult it was to get Woody to talk to you. He's the friend of the other Westmore.
Yeah.
But I'm interested to talk about that, but also I'm interested in this juxtaposition between Woody and Justin.
That's a good question. So the Woody story, and Woody was fascinating because Woody was best friend. Woody is Wes's best friend. And I remember when I first reached out to Woody because I started hearing his name more and more. And I said, okay, if I got to get this story, I got to talk to Woody. You can't not talk to Woody. So I contact Woody, and I'm asking Woody questions like, hey, you know, my name is Wes Moore. I explained to him that I reached out to Wes a while ago, but now I've decided to turn this into a book. And I start asking Woody questions. And I'm like, so Woody, so what was it like growing up in Baltimore? It was fine. All right, Woody. So what was school like in Baltimore? It was cool. I mean, he was giving me nothing, nothing. And then one day I get a call from Woody. It must have been like a Thursday. And he said, what are you doing on Saturday? And I was kind of taken aback. I was like, nothing. Why? What's going on? And he's like, I talked to Wes, and he says you're a good dude. And he said that you're just trying to help some kids. So I'm going to show you some stuff. And then that Saturday, we went out for hours. And he just took me around old spots they used to hang out at, where they used to sell drugs at. It was to the point I was like, all right, Woody, I've seen enough.
I'm done.
But it took Wes almost, you know, really helping to grease that path for both his family and friends to say, I need you all to cooperate. Because I knew that the only way I could do this process justice is if I didn't go into it judgmental. And I also knew the only way I could do this process justice is if I got transparency from people. And not just from his side, but from my side. I needed my family and friends to be honest with me in ways that they'd never been honest with me before. And there are a lot of stories that come up in the book. These are things I didn't know. I didn't know about some of the challenges. I didn't know about my mother's abusive first relationship. I didn't know any of this stuff until I first started digging, and I explained to my family, I need you all to be honest with me, because the only way this can be helpful is if this is honest. And then finally people opened up. But it's a good question about Woody versus Justin, because Justin was my best friend growing up, and Justin grew up in the neighborhood in the Bronx, and went to that same school across town with me. And we were two of the only black kids inside the entire place. And Justin, similar type of situation. He lived in public housing in the South Bronx, and it was just his mother. His father lived over in Harlem, and it was Justin and his older sister Nikki, who was actually ironically my older sister's name. So Justin and I really grew up literally together like brothers the entire time, similar to Wes and Woody. Justin was always someone who was always pushing me to do more. Justin had a certain maturity about him that really went well beyond his years. Justin was also one of the smartest kids in the class, despite having the same type of issues that I had in terms of neighborhood and family and community, etc. But he always managed to do really well. And Justin was always someone that continued to make me drive for more, even when I kept on trying to push him back and almost try to bring him down to mm-hmm. where I was. Versus Woody, I think Woody did better than Wes in school. Woody made it through high school. But I think Woody got caught up in the streets in very similar ways that Wes did. And so I don't think you had that same natural pull relationship that Justin really had with me, that even though we were peers, in many ways, Justin almost became a role model to me. Justin was almost this example to me of what I should do, versus Woody and Wes were peers, but I don't think had that similar type of relationship.
And actually, it's interesting, both Justin and Woody. I mean, Justin went through a lot, obviously, from reading a book, but he went through just be here now.
Yeah, I mean, his mother died when he was a teenager. His father died when he was in college. His father died in a tragic house fire. He beat cancer when he was a teenager. I mean, Justin is just a remarkable survivor. When you think about everything that's happened within his life, and he kept on pushing.
And Woody,
he's still my best friend to this day.
And Woody has gotten his act together.
And
seems like
Woody has gotten his act together. Woody's working on it. But Woody, I tell you, I mean, I could never have gotten this information and gone through this process had Woody not been as open and honest as he's been.
Really, I'm just on the real Westmore. The other young Westmore was in the street. The streets kind of gobble him up. You tell that story about when the one ray of hope when he came out of Job Corps.
Yes, and which was, you know, there were certain scenes and interviews that have been really tough with Wes and I, and that was one, because we spent the entire hour of our visit going over Job Corps. And it's interesting, because the way I did my interviews is I'm never allowed to bring pens or paper or tape recorders when I go see Wes. I just ask him questions, and then we say goodbye, and then I run back to my car, and there's a tape recorder sitting in the passenger seat of my car, and then I just basically regurgitate what he said for the next 20 minutes in my car. After that Job Corps interview, I literally had to sit in the car for about 20, 30 minutes and just sit there and absorb what I just heard. Because after Wes had been in the streets for a while, he went to the Job Corps, and he said the Job Corps is one of the most important times of his life. He got his GED. He realized he was reading at a sophomore in college reading level. He became a role model to the other kids in the Job Corps program. And he felt like a lot of the challenges and a lot of the drama that he had back in Baltimore, it just floated off his shoulders when he was in the Job Corps because he felt like he remade himself. And after leaving the Job Corps, he went back in the neighborhood and he was working at best odd jobs because he couldn't find, you know, a place to work. He was making $6.50, $7 an hour, but at this time he also had four children. He also had two mothers of his children who needed help. He had his mother who needed help. And Wes increasingly found himself unable to provide for not just himself, but for everyone else that now relied on him. And after months of leaving the Job Corps and really feeling like he was getting himself back on track, he went back to what he knew, which was going back to the corners. And it tells a larger story as well about just the challenge of recidivism and the challenge for so many guys who come out of prison. And because you see this story that happened with Wes, and it's a very common story. And so how exactly he dealt with it and going back to the streets, you know, really was a real heartbreaking road part because you saw how close he was to getting out and just wasn't able to do it.
And so I'm curious what this has taught you. I'm curious because let me set it up this way.
Yeah.
I mean, you know the inner city streets and the poor working class streets because you had to live in them in the Bronx. Mm-hmm. But you had this life that ended up in military academy and being a scholar at Johns Hopkins University, a star football player, and then you ended up as a Rhodes Scholar, going to Oxford University, and you worked on Wall Street, and you worked in the White House under President Bush, and you spoke at Andesco Field before President Barack Obama accepted the nomination to become the candidate for the Democratic Party. I remember your speech that day because I was there early covering it, and I didn't know who you were then until the book came out. I went, oh, no, that's that same guy. So, and then, you're a combat veteran of the war in Afghanistan, the 82nd Airborne. And so you've got this life, and so... And clearly involved in the political social life of our country, and you're married, and your world's taking off. You know, you're what, 43, 4, 1,
31.
39, 35, 32, what are you?
31.
31. So I am not good at ages. I'm not good with ages at all. You could have been 53 or you could have been 22. I have no idea. So I'm really bad at those things. So yeah. And I have kids that same age as you.
Right.
So you're on a trajectory. On the other hand, you have all the Westmores of the world.
Yeah.
And the streets of Baltimore and L.A. and San Francisco and New York and everywhere are full of Westmores. Yeah. So we have this dichotomy. So I'm curious what all this is teaching. What is it saying to you about where this country has to go and what's the nexus of building a country where that world doesn't exist? I mean, what is it saying to you? What's all this saying to you now?
Well, one thing I wanted to show with this book is that this book is not the story of the exceptions. This book is questioning why we have so many exceptions in our society in the first place. You know, what is the nexus? What is causing these disparities that exist and these disparities that are not in any way decreasing, that are actually increasing in our society with every year that goes by? And one thing that I think this helps to show, and one thing I wanted this book to help to show, is how little separates us from another life altogether, and how little interventions, how the smallest of conversations, how the smallest of interventions and mentoring and supports can make a huge difference. Because one thing I realized after doing all these hours of interviews is exactly what was said, is that, as I said on the cover of the book, is that the chilling truth is that his story could have been mine. And the tragedy is that my story could have been his. And had it not been for people who stepped in when they didn't have to, but who stepped in and said, we're going to help and we're going to support, and we're going to come up with aggressive and creative ways to intervene in the life of this young boy. And what was missing from him was that aggressive and creative intervention that could have made all the difference. And what you fundamentally have was two kids who at similar times in our life were both searching for help. They were hurt. They were confused. They were angry. And one of the kids got help and the other kid didn't. And now the world bears witness to the final results of either our attention as a society or our apathy as a society. So what I hope this book will be and what I've really learned from it is that it's a larger call to action. It's a larger understanding for all of us to understand and put faces to these statistics and put faces to these anecdotes that we hear, that we sometimes can just kind of push things off to the side and say, that's not our business. That's not our neighborhood. It doesn't affect us. And what these stories help to show is that they do affect us, and not just in terms of the way the negative can come around and affect every community, but it's the absence of the positives that could come out and actually affect communities. One thing I know is the truth. I mean, if we believe that the cure for ALS was being born in West Baltimore right now, if we believe that the cure for cancer was being born in the South Bronx, if we believe that the person that would really put an end to nuclear proliferation was being born in the South Side of Chicago or in the Mississippi Delta, then we would do whatever it takes to make sure that we can actually extract that information and that knowledge from it. But the question is, as a society, do we? As a society, do we really believe that? And I believe that these communities are not the problems. These communities are the answers to our problems, as long as we're willing to have that fundamental paradigm shift, as long as we're willing to have that fundamental psychological shift. And I'm hoping that these two stories will illuminate the fact that how little separates us from another life altogether, where as long as we're willing to help, as long as we're willing to step in and intervene, that we really can literally not just change communities but change the world, as long as we're willing to make that effort.
So tell me what role, I mean, do people like you play in that at this point? Yeah. I mean, if the cards and stars are with you, you have a long life ahead of you.
Yeah.
Right?
God willing.
God willing. But, you know, as I read right, you're working on Wall Street now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is a much maligned place at the moment.
It is.
Because of what the greed of that place has wrought on the world.
And it deserves much of that criticism.
So with your feet in all these worlds,
yeah.
I mean, how do you see people in your position addressing this issue?
You know, it was fascinating even going through this process over the past couple of years while I was working in finance, because, you know, my process was I would literally wake up at 5:30 every morning and write for a couple hours before going to work. And it was amazing to me that when you start your day reading articles about a police officer and a father of five who went to work one day and didn't come home, or you start your day reading articles or reading letters from a person who's spending the rest of their life in prison for the crime, it helps to add a certain context to your whole day, and it helps to put everything else in perspective. And one thing I fundamentally and firmly believe is that public service doesn't need to be an occupation, but it must be a way of life. It's a way of life for all of us. It's something that we all can have some type of involvement and all can have some type of way of getting involved. The part of this book I'm probably most proud of is actually the back of the book. Because in the back of the book,
the epilogue,
the resource guide.
Oh, the resource guide.
Yeah.
That's where I was going next.
We literally list over 200 organizations around the country that are on the ground doing the work. And what I really call it, it's the guide. It's where to go to help or where to go for help. So if you are a single mother in Baltimore or Memphis, and you're like, you know, hey, I heard this story and this sounds so much like my son and I could really use help, we're here organizations that are on the ground doing the work that would love to hear from you. Or if you're a philanthropist in down at the harbor or in New York or in L.A. and you hear and you read these stories and you say, man, I'd love to get involved. I'd love to donate some time or resources or whatever.
They're all there.
These are places who would love to hear from you. And, you know, in addition to that, I'm actually donating a significant portion of all book proceeds to two organizations. One is called City Year, which is started up in Boston, but it's a national organization that gives young people a year of public service and allows them to be part of something bigger than themselves. They're the ones we all see wearing the red jackets.
Right.
And the other organization is the U.S. Dream Academy, which is actually a Maryland-based organization, but a national organization that supports children of the incarcerated for kids who have one or both parents who are behind bars to help break that cycle so these kids don't feel like that is something that they necessarily have to do themselves. And so the way I feel like we can get involved, the way I plan on being involved, is I plan on, regardless of what the occupation is, I'm a public servant. And that's who I fundamentally want to be. And then whether it be when I was working in the White House with the 80s as a paratrooper with the 82nd, or working in communities that I live and work in, these things matter to me. And I know the difference that can be made as long as we get involved, because I've seen it in my own life. And that's what I'm trying to extract out of so many young people that we still work with to this day.
Westmore, it's been just a pleasure to meet you and have you in the studio. Mark, I'm looking forward to this.
It's been an honor. It's been an honor, sincerely. I'm so grateful, and I'm a huge fan, and I'm really grateful for all your hard work. But
thank you so much. Good to have you. Westmore, the other Westmore, One Name, Two Fates, a book worth wrestling with. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our interns are Judith Lloyd, Brian Boone, Richard Good, Gay Pinder, and Felicia Faison. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.